So what are we hearing here?
This is a stir bar in one of our respirometry vessels that keeps bacterial cells mixing constantly and makes sure that oxygen gets in so that the cells can respire or breathe, essentially. And then in this whole instrument, we're measuring how the cells grow and respond to the nanoparticles that we expose them to.
Welcome to the Sustainable Nano Podcast. I'm Miriam Kraus, and today we're talking about some flake-shaped nanoparticles that are found in batteries and what they do to a bacterium called Shewanella onidensis. The sounds you're hearing are from the lab where I talked with Ian Gonsolis, who at the time was a fifth-year chemistry doctoral student at the University of Minnesota. He has since graduated. Congratulations, Ian. He was recently co-first author on a research paper along with fellow student Mimi Hang.
Hi, my name is Mimi Hang.
So Mimi, Ian, and seven other students and faculty members from the Center for Sustainable Nanotechnology recently had this paper published in the journal Chemistry of Materials, and we're trying to record some cool sounds from the lab here where Ian did part of his research. But a lot of the instruments are just really quiet.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of what else would be in like a microscope, a plate reader.
One other thing I could think of. Flame sterilizes a lot of things.
So the instant this ignites, it'll make a little bit of sound.
That's awesome. So what is that used for?
So we flame sterilize any glassware that comes in contact with bacteria.
Okay, so now that we have shamelessly used a blowtorch to get your attention, here's the rest of my actual interview with Mimi and Ian about their research into what happens when a battery nanomaterial called NMC comes into contact with a certain soil-dwelling bacteria.
Yeah, so we're doing this podcast because you guys had a paper come out recently, and we thought it would be potentially interesting to non-chemists to learn about. So what was the main purpose of the study? What did you do, and what did you learn?
Sure. So part of the Center for Sustainable Nanotechnology, we're really interested in impacting next generation production of materials. So a material that we were really interested in are lithium intercalation compounds, which would be utilized as cathode materials for batteries. And these would be, commercialized on a very large scale. They would be used in electric vehicles. And to a certain extent, the cell phones and the batteries you have now are lithium-ion based. So anyway, in a typical electric vehicle, you can imagine something like 38 kilograms of cathode material. So as you can imagine, through production, it just use and disposal, there's high probability that these materials will be released into the environment.
Cool. So that actually leads to my next follow-up question, which was, Mimi, could you talk for a second just about like how a battery works? Remind us what's a cathode, what's an intercalation material, that kind of stuff?
Sure. I mean, in the simplest way that I look at this, a battery contains an anode and a cathode. And these materials often have to have the capability of essentially producing electrons, right? And so we do that in a typical battery in this setting by having materials that are layered, and the layers are of metal oxides, such as cobalt oxide, or in this case, nickel manganese cobalt oxide. And then you have these atoms, which are, lithium, and the lithium can move in and out between the anode and the cathode. And when it moves back and forth between the anode and the cathode, it produces some current.
So is the anode and the cathode, is that like on a AA battery where there's the bumpy end and the flat end? Is that those two?
I guess you can say that. So a AAA battery or something like that, those are a little bit different, right? So those are alkaline batteries. So it works a little different. But yes, those also have an anode and a cathode.
Okay. And then in a lithium-ion battery like are in most cell phones or laptops or whatever, are those nanomaterial-based, or is the NMC being a nanomaterial, is that part of what's kind of new about it?
I would say right now, the industrial standard and, you know, what people are producing on a large scale for commercialization is not nanoscale at all. And that's something that's also really important to notice. But you can imagine that if you're trying to shuttle lithium in and out of the material, you know, having higher surface area to volume makes a lot of sense because you're changing the diffusion of, you know, these lithium atoms in and out of the material. So, you know, that's just one of the reasons why industry is moving toward making nanoscale materials for you know, such an application. So we're interested in how these materials will interact with environmental systems. And, you know, the other thing about next generation materials is we know the field is moving toward nanomaterials. So, you know, the current state of the art cathode particles, such as lithium, nickel, manganese, cobalt oxide, are actually fairly large. They're upwards of a micron or so in size. But we're really interested in, you know, the nano sheets that potentially may be used in future technologies. But something that we did observe in our paper was that if you take the current generation cathode material, they're fairly large, like I mentioned, you know, above a micron, and you actually cycle it, so you actually use it in a battery setting, the material itself will start to break down. And when it breaks down, it forms nanoflakes. So it forms sheets that, you know, we're already synthesizing and making here to study the impact of Schuonella of here in this case. So in a way, we're studying the material from two ends. One, in the sense that it's a next generation material. You know, the nanomaterial side is next generation, but also the current generation material will break down to look like their nano size.
That's cool. I didn't know that before.
Yeah. So that's where Ian comes in and his expertise in the Haynes lab, where they have a bacterial model system that they can analyze the environmental impact of. Ian, do you want to take that part?
Sure. So as Mimi mentioned, with increasing use of nanomaterials like NMC, there's increasing likelihood of the materials entering the natural environment. For example, if you dispose of a battery in a landfill and it cracks open and starts leaching its contents out, that's one potential way these materials could enter the environment. So what we're trying to understand in the Haynes lab is how these materials behave in the environment and use that information to design safer and more sustainable nanomaterials, hopefully. So we use a bacterial model system, as Mimi said, to understand or probe this behavior of nanomaterials in the environment. The bacterium that we use is called Schuonella onidensis, and like any model system, it's not a perfect model of the entire environment, obviously, but we pick Schuonella because as a genus, they're widely distributed around the globe. So whatever we learn about this particular species, we hope is applicable to many different environments. And Schuonella can also live in both aerobic and anaerobic environments, meaning with and without oxygen. So they're found in many different places. And the particular species we work with plays an important role in the environment by cycling minerals. So in this study, what we did is we took Schuonella and we exposed it to the NMC nanomaterial, and we studied how it responds, meaning how it grows or doesn't grow in the presence of NMC. And then we designed a series of experiments to try to figure out how the material which we found is toxic to Schuonella. What's the mechanism of that toxicity?
So like what is the nanomaterial doing to the bacterium to make it less healthy?
Exactly.
So okay.
If we can understand that mechanism, that's hopefully the information we can use to design a safer material.
So can you talk a little bit about what, like how did you know that the nanomaterials were having a negative impact on the bacteria? What did the results look like in that way? Or how did you set it up so that you could tell what was happening?
The two ways that we measured how NMC impacted bacteria were by measuring the number of cells present and also measuring how much oxygen they respire, or in a sense, how much they're breathing. So the first method, measuring how many cells are present, we basically shine light on a sample of bacteria. We see how much of that light scatters. and the amount that it scatters is proportional to how many cells are there. When we exposed the populations of bacteria to NMC, we saw that there were fewer cells present over time. So a healthy sample would grow over time. The ones exposed to NMC were somewhat stagnant or actually died off over time. The second method, where we measure how much the cells breathe or consume oxygen, showed pretty similar things. So we have a sample of healthy bacteria, their oxygen consumption and their breathing increases as they grow. When we expose the bacteria to NMC, we saw huge delays in bacterial respiration. So if the normal sample grew in 5-10 hours, we saw huge increase in oxygen respiration that was maybe delayed by an entire day when we exposed them to NMC. So what that really tells us is that NMC is killing off some of the bacteria that are initially present and really delaying that growth.
Cool. And then, so just to clarify, each bacterium is one cell, right? And then the,
yep.
So when you say, okay, so 100 cells would be like 100 bacteria.
Right.
Cool. And then the light scattering technique sounds very interesting. Can you give an analogy of like on a kind of day-to-day? So say if you have, I'm trying to picture like if you have a glass of water and then you put some crud in it, it's going to look cloudy. Is that kind of similar where the light diffracts differently basically when there's more stuff in there?
Right. So if you have like a glass of cloudy water and you shine light on it and then you detect the amount of light that passes through in a straight line from your source, the more and more the light is scattered, the less and less light you'll detect at the detection point in a straight line from your light source. So that's essentially what we're doing with bacteria too. Instead of a glass of cloudy water, we have a little cuvette that's filled with bacteria, and we're just measuring how much light is passing through, which really tells us how much was scattered away.
Mm-hmm. So this next question is actually Mimi and I talked about it very briefly last time, but we didn't kind of come to any conclusions. I'm curious if you have a sense of so 5 milligrams per liter is the amount mentioned in the abstract of the paper that you use to do these tests. How was that chosen? Does it translate to any like real life concentration? Can you give us a sense of what 5 milligrams per liter looks like as a concentration of something?
Sure. So I'll answer those separately.
Okay.
The way the concentration was actually chosen for the study was based on a dose response curve, meaning we exposed the bacterial model to various concentrations of NMC, and we saw which concentrations are causing the bacterial population to be negatively impacted. So 5 milligrams per liter was something that gave a pretty significant response, meaning it was fairly toxic to the cells. So we chose that concentration to move forward with our other experiments because it actually allows us to see an effect and be able to measure a change in bacterial function. That allows us to address questions much more readily in the lab.
Because you're interested not only in is it toxic, but in what way and like over what time span and that kind of thing. Is that fair to say?
Exactly. So it's that part of it that really requires using a concentration that induces an effect. We can't really hope to determine the mechanism of how it's toxic if it's, we're using a concentration so low that it's just barely doing anything. But then how does it translate into a real life concentration? All you can really do is say how much material is being used in a single commercial product, how many of those products will be made, and how many of them will enter a landfill or some other route where they could then enter the environment as a whole. So if, as Mimi said before, if a single electric vehicle's battery holds about 40 kilograms or 38 kilograms of NMC, if all of that were to leak out, it would need to leak out into a volume of about 7,500 liters or a little over 2,000 gallons of water to achieve the concentration that we used in the study of 5 milligrams per liter. So I can't really comment on what do we expect that to happen or not, because these materials aren't actually out in the environment yet. The first generation of electric vehicles hopefully are still working and their batteries aren't in the landfill. But that's the kind of calculation we come to.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a challenge, right? Because we don't know to what scale these materials will be released into the environment. And, you know, is 5 milligrams per liter reasonable? Well, maybe. You can think at a local disposal site where material, you know, just the entire battery is chucked into a landfill site, then, well, yeah, the interaction with the soil bacterium there may be on the order of 5, 50 even milligrams per liter. But, yeah, it's hard to say what that would, you know, what the exposure concentration would be. And so for us, we're, like what Ian said, we're looking to see if there is any impact, what would it be? And Miriam, you also, I think last time when we talked about, you know, what does 5 milligrams per liter actually mean? And Ian right. gave a really good analogy to that. But I guess the other way I would think of it is, the unit, another way of looking at it is it's a parts per million. Mm-hmm. So I guess if you assume in a glass of water you have one, you know, about a million drops of water, then 5 of those drops are pure lithium nickel manganese cobalt oxide.
That's great. That's a, yeah, it's a very good image.
Yeah.
So yeah, either 5 drops in a glass of water or an entire battery worth of materials in, what did you say, 2,000 gallons or liters?
Yeah, yep.
Yeah.
About 2,000 gallons.
Cool, that's really helpful. So this, forgive me, this isn't an ignorant question, but would you ever like just like go get a battery and break it open and use those nanomaterials? Do we know how similar they are to the stuff that you were making?
Oh, sure, we thought about that a lot. You can definitely do that. The only thing is, in industry, there are proprietary coatings, there are, you know, there's a lot of stuff inside a battery that's proprietary, and you don't know what you're dealing with.
Okay.
And so to just split it open and test the toxicity of, you'll probably learn something, but it will be harder to get at the mechanism of the interaction, because there's just so many variables, and you have no control over what you're looking at.
Gotcha. That leads to, into kind of the next part of the question, which is like, what was the most fun or the most exciting? Or it sounds like it was, it felt all along like it was going to be kind of an important high impact thing.
I think for me the most exciting part was not seeing that the material was toxic to bacteria or that it was inhibiting their growth, but actually finding out the mechanism of that. And that took quite a few experimental trials where we were evaluating potential mechanisms of toxicity that didn't turn out to be happening. And so it really felt like a spark of inspiration to think about the dissolution of the material. It's great data for Mimi about exactly how much of the metal ions is being released, and then seeing that there was extremely good overlap in the bacterial response to the nanomaterial and to the metal ions that were released from it.
So what were some of the other things that you had tested as possible candidates for what was causing this?
Well, one of the hypotheses that we had early on was that because NMC is a flake-like structure and has a very thin profile, we thought that the material could potentially cut open holes in the bacterial cell membrane, kind of slice them open.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the first mechanisms we looked at was bacterial cell membrane integrity after exposure to NMC. And I was pretty surprised to find that bacterial cell membranes, after really short exposures to the material, but long enough that they should be able to poke holes if they were going to, were not poking any holes at all.
Mm-hmm.
This NMC also didn't seem to even attach to the cell surface at all. And that really made me question why the material is toxic if it doesn't even have a very close interaction with the cells.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, it makes sense that the material is releasing metal ions. Those can diffuse freely into solution, and it doesn't require that the particle or the flake be attached to a cell or slicing off the cell.
Does it even require that it be nanoscale? Like if you had some kind of nickel, magnesium, cobalt bulk thing, would it have a similar effect?
It definitely does not require that it be nanoscale, but the rate of dissolution of a material will be different at the nanoscale versus in the bulk. So in that sense, being nanoscale does matter. The actual mechanism of interaction with the organism isn't dependent on this being a nanomaterial, but the amount and the rate that these metal ions are being released definitely is impacted by the fact that it's nanomaterial.
I mean, a flake, for instance, you know, the ones that we're working with are just over 100 nanometers in diameter and just, you know, less than 5 nanometers in thickness. And so this is like a piece of paper, if you want to look at it that way. It's really high surface area. So there's a higher chance for nickel and cobalt to be released as compared to something that's like it's a big boulder, right? So you imagine a sheet of paper next to a boulder. Well, the sheet of paper is probably going to dissolve out faster than the boulder right next to it.
Yeah, that's a really good analogy. Or like if you actually think of something made of the same material, like a sheet of paper versus a block of wood.
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah. Or a very thin slab of wood, a very thin slab of rock versus a boulder, I guess. Yeah, so however you want to look at it.
Mm-hmm. Or yeah, it's winter here in the Midwest, so thinking about also like if you just have a tiny thin layer of ice, it's going to melt way faster than if you have like a big snowbank or a giant block. And that the material, whatever's frozen in there, is going to get distributed all around much quicker. So I think that's a helpful to have that analogy. How about you, Mimi? What was the most exciting or fun aspect of the project for you?
You know, my first thought was similar to what Ian just mentioned. Mm-hmm. I think it was really exciting to when we were able to nail down what the mechanism of toxicity was. Because by learning what the mechanism is, we can change the way we make the material, we can change the way it's being produced. And that's where, you know, the greatest impact is, you know, how do we get to a material that's sustainable, right? So going back to the idea of sustainability. So yeah, the mechanism was the most interesting part. But I guess if I were to mention other things, you know, I would say the lab exchanges were also really exciting. You know, me going to Ian's, you know, lab and really seeing how he does a lot of the experiments and learning about the biology, that was really exciting to me because I never had that opportunity before. So it was, you know, it was a great learning experience and helped me to evolve as a scientist.
Awesome. Something in what you just said. Oh, so that actually leads into my kind of last question I had on the list for you guys was about what should non-scientists take away from this? And you mentioned about like battery manufacturers can potentially learn something useful from this. Are there other kind of take-home messages that you would think would be interesting or useful to, again, people who aren't researching in the field but just are interested in the science?
Well, one study we mentioned or cite in the manuscript that was just accepted is that there's currently limited incentives for recycling these materials, limited economic incentives for recycling the materials. And so based on the results of our study, which show that NMC can leach these metal ions and is toxic to bacteria, we think it's important that manufacturers and regulators, whoever is involved with the life cycle of the material, consider the need to recycle it so that this material isn't entering the environment in large quantities.
I think that last part bears repeating. This kind of research isn't just interesting to scientists who study nanoparticles. There are a lot of manufacturers and regulators and others involved in nanomaterial production and use at various levels, and it's important for them to consider the need for recycling now so these materials don't enter the environment in large quantities and leave us wondering how to clean up after the fact. It's a tough thing to ask for. I think a lot of our infrastructure right now is set up to be pretty reactive, responding to problems after they happen, rather than trying to anticipate and prevent them. But hopefully things like this podcast can help bring attention to these issues and help us use science to benefit society in a really broad way. So thanks very much for listening to this episode of the Sustainable Nano Podcast. Sustainable Nano is a production of the Center for Sustainable Nanotechnology, which is funded by a grant from the National Science Foundation. Here's our disclaimer. This material is based upon work supported by the National Science Foundation under the Center for Sustainable Nanotechnology grant. But any opinions, findings, and conclusions or recommendations expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of the National Science Foundation or the participating institutions. Thank you to the National Science Foundation. And of course, thanks to Ian Gonsolas and Mimi Hang for doing the recording with me and for leading the way on this really cool research project. Want more sustainable nano? We've been writing a blog for a couple years now. You can read over 175 archived posts at sustainable-nano.com. You can also get more information about each podcast episode at sustainable-nano.com/podcast. We've got one more podcast episode coming out this week for our launch, and it's coming out tomorrow. It's going to be awesome. It is all about a group of high school students who created their own nanotechnology-based superheroes. So we hope you'll tune in for that. We hope you will subscribe on iTunes to the podcast, maybe leave us a review, and let us know what you think of the podcast so far. Thanks for listening.
Okay.
All
right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, guys. Thank you again.
See you guys later.
Thanks.